Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Hello, and welcome to the Big Change Podcast, where we are exploring how ordinary Christians can change their world. My name is Jonathan Wilson, and I'm your host. Today, we are joined by my very good friend, Sammy Njenga. Sammy and I go back a long way. We were driving in the car together on the way to recording today and just sharing stories about some of the tough experiences we had in the early days of post-apartheid South Africa and the work we did back then in leadership development. Conversations that very much speak to the issues that we're going to be looking at today, which is how do you, as a Christian, or if you're not a Christian, how do you take on big change in a world where the systems that need to be changed are so big, so complicated, and in a way seem to be completely untouchable? And that's what Sammy is here to join me for. Sammy is a systems thinking consultant and has a background in leadership development and organizational change and many other things that we'll go into shortly. But Sammy, welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you for having me here.
That's great to have you. Let me do a bit of a review for listeners as to where this podcast series has been going, what we've been covering. So the Big Change series has been looking at large-scale social change through the biblical lens of reconciliation, specifically that in order for God to achieve the reconciling work that he is doing in this world, which is bringing all things into right order, right relationship with himself, and people with each other, and people with creation, and creation, in a sense, being in right order with itself. This can be covered by four R's that we've been looking at over the course of the series. The first R being rescue, the second R being reorientation, the third R being repair, and the fourth R being reordering. These are all dimensions of reconciliation. We have to be rescued out of our own brokenness. That rescue puts us in a place where we can start to be reoriented in our mental maps, in a sense. There's repair that needs to be done and brokenness that needs to be healed. And then there's the actual putting back into right order of things that are disordered, things that are part of society, things that are within our own lives. And we've looked at this through many different stories and lenses, the last being with Andy Crouch, where Andy and I asked the question, well, what about, especially for those of us as Christians, we are looking at, you know, playing a role in big change. We're looking at the role of Christians in that. And yet when we look back in history, we see how many times Christians have actually either failed in achieving big change or actually contributed to big failure themselves. And in a sense, Sammy, what you and I are taking on today is an extension of that same topic, where we're saying, where do you even start when we know that we are ourselves as Christians weak, incompetent, flawed, and yet we know that God calls us to be a part of large-scale change, but where do we start? And where do you start when we know that there's a personal dimension, that there are personal wrongs that need to be addressed, but at the same time, where there are massive and complex wrongs that need to be addressed? And today, we're specifically going to be looking at the issue of slavery, especially as it manifested in the early Roman Empire and how Christians engaged with it then. So let me give listeners a little bit more of your background, and then I'd love to hear some of your own observations around what is so big that stands against us. So Sammy, like I said, is a leadership and management consultant. He comes from a systems thinking kind of background. And as I said, he's been involved in change management, leadership development, organizational learning and viability, strategic alignment, organizational transformation. These are all areas in which he's worked. He's very interested in specifically African perspectives on systems change. And to do this, he's worked with everybody from companies like Maersk, Salesforce. He's worked with Centec. He's worked with a Development Bank of Namibia. You've worked with the KwaZulu-Natal Growth Fund. And I know you've also had other government clients here in South Africa, the National Treasury. And then Sammy is also adjunct faculty at the Henley Business School of Africa, at Stellenbosch Business School, and the University of the Free State Business School. So Sammy, how do you resonate with or respond to what I mentioned earlier around large-scale systems change and the challenge that it poses to us?
Thanks, Jonathan, and thanks for having me here. So there's something I know, or I think I know, some theory, some form of knowledge, but there's what happens in practice. So I get into a government department, they're in trouble, they're calling for help. I come in there, there's what I know and how I know we should go around this. But then they're sitting there, they don't want to be there. They want to be back in the office because they're being monitored on templates and plans and reports that they need to complete. And I sit there thinking, so what am I doing here? And the frustration of not being able to do that which is meaningful. And there are times, many times, when I have walked out of a government department or a big corporate and just shake my head and in disbelief that at what I thought could have been, but actually ended up not being.
Yeah. And do you think that what people are looking for in those situations is they're wanting a technique, like a transactional process,
yeah,
that leads to the kinds of outcomes they'd hope for?
Yeah. A lot of times we're looking for a quick fix. We're looking for something. Give me that one magical bullet, one magical pill that if we take, we'll sort out this problem. I remember being in an organization where they said to me, give us something we can put on the walls to change the behavior of our staff. And I said, there's nothing you can put on the wall that will change the behavior of the staff. We've got to take them through a process which we will put something on the wall as a reminder. And then they said, no, your process is too long, so let's get somebody. And they got a consultant who gave them something on the wall. So they want to be able to say, we've ticked that box, we've done that, and life moves on.
Yeah. So Sammy, you have two kids. One is in varsity, one is graduated. She's now in the working world. What do they see when they look at systems? Maybe they don't use systems change language, but when they look at the systems around them and they see what needs to change or they believe something needs to change, what are you seeing that they feel that they're up against?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we were talking with my daughter last night and I said, so how has it been being in Cape Town and working in Cape Town over the last 3 months? And she says, Daddy, there's so many homeless people here. There's so many people on the street. And it bothers me that every place I turn, there are homeless people. There are people lying on the streets and begging on the streets. And I'm not sure whether it's because there are more homeless people than other places. I don't know whether that's the case. But she's conscious of that, and that bothers her. She's mentioned other aspects. For example, the intolerance, even within the church, for diverse thinking, for divergent thinking. There's almost, in the places where she has been, there's almost one line of thinking. And if you are not thinking like this, if you come, for example, questioning your own faith or questioning your own sexual orientation or whatever it is, then you don't fit in to the mainstream. And so those are the kind of things that have bothered her, that she's very in touch, and both of them actually very in touch with what's going on in Russia and Ukraine and what's going on in Gaza. And because these images are there on our television screens and on our laptops and so on. And she feels concerned that why are we not able to do anything about what is going on? How can we live in a world that seems to normalize that it's okay for 40,000 people to be killed? It's okay for helpless children to be butchered in a concert. So those are the kind of things they are wrestling with.
Yeah. I'm hoping that today's podcast allows listeners to recognize, firstly, as Christians, we don't pursue change primarily from the foundation of the competence that we bring, but from the foundation of a God who is faithfully at work in this world. But also, more specifically, there are ways to engage our ugly, complicated world in which these systems that we're talking about seem to be completely unmovable or immovable, intractable. And the ways to engage are maybe not the ways that you would think. We typically think, for example, well, if, and we're going to be looking at the issue of slavery shortly, if the problem is slavery, then the solution is some kind of aggressive campaign, mobilizing as many people as possible, institute some laws. The laws say that this institution is wrong, and now we've solved the problem. And in a way, that's like the paper on the wall that your government clients are asking for.
Exactly. But maybe, Jonathan, we need to go a little bit back and say, how do we arrive at these situations, these complex, messy situations, before we start saying, how do we address them? And what's intriguing for me is that when we find some of these complex and messy situations, they often, the people, the individuals involved are good people, if I may use that. So in themselves, they would actually be horrified by the outcomes that come from the total sum of it. So for, it's the individuals themselves may be actually very good people, very committed to ethics and justice and non-corruption. But when they come together, there's something that happens where, and that's what we talk about in systems thinking, is that the behavior of the entire system changes and it becomes a beast on its own. So I have met people, for example, even within government, who when you meet them one-on-one, they're really good, ethical, they sound ethical, they're really committed to good principles and so on. They want to see good change in society. But when they come together in the collective, and something happens, there's a dynamic that arises, and that collective gets outcomes that are very different from what the individuals would have aspired to. I often think about, for example, when we say we're driving the rhino to extinction. I don't think anybody buying rhino horn would be saying to you, I want to drive the rhino to extinction. They're thinking about themselves. I want rhino horn because for whatever reason they want to have it. But collectively, we start finding outcomes that are not what we would have intended in the beginning. This morning, we were driving through traffic. And again, what is traffic? You hear someone saying, oops, I'm horrified about this traffic. But you are the traffic.
Right.
You are the traffic. And that's part of the problem, that the traffic is caused by you and I, who didn't leave home to come and create traffic. But by being on that road at that particular point, there's a pattern of interactions that creates the undesired outcome that we want to see. And I think what we are talking about in terms of change is how do we work with those patterns of interactions and relationships, but towards godly, towards kingdom, towards something that is a common good.
That's really good. And interestingly, so just literally, I think maybe on this past Friday, that before the weekend, a friend wrote to me out of the blue. I haven't talked to this guy for 10 years, maybe more. And he is a marketing consultant in Canada. And he reminded me of a conversation that we'd had, I think around 2012, where he had come to me with this question: I believe that as a Christian, I can play a role in changing how the business world works and how marketing is thought of and how marketing is done. But in order to even be present in the system, I have to play a certain game. And I feel that just that alone already, I'm in a situation of compromise. And I think unwittingly, you know, maybe there's some of us who somehow we've managed to keep our noses clean, and we don't believe that we participate in anything like that. We don't compromise. But in reality, any system that you sit in some way, you personally are contributing to something wrong. Something that is unjust or broken in some way. And sometimes you can't help it. That system is what makes life work, as wrong as it is. I think of, again, we're going to be looking at slavery in the Roman times shortly, but there's slavery today. And I think probably the average listener would firmly stand against it. They would see, and we would see, that the times that we're in are enlightened. It's been a couple hundred years since we banned slavery and made it completely illegal. United Nations Charter of Human Rights would obviously see slavery as completely unacceptable. But the reality is that you and I and everybody in this studio with us today, we participate in some aspects of slavery today. Yeah. If we're using a smartphone, we've probably helped that what we purchased there, that financial contribution has enabled some form of slavery.
Yeah. And I recently found, I mean, you're even talking about things that, where they buy shoes and things like that. But I found myself in an organization where I was paid by the time I spent in that organization to coach some people. So what happens when they don't show up? So then I decide, okay, let me build into my contract that even if they don't show up, I'll still charge for the time because I've traveled there. I mean, I was there a lot of times and there were no people showing up. But the contract is supposed to go on for a year. And so if inevitably, I actually remember one night at midnight, I woke up and I wrote a poem to myself in which I said, I am the problem here. Because these people are using me to justify the expense and say, look, we are doing something about it. It's serving my need because I am sitting there and I'll still get paid. But ultimately, the citizen on the ground is actually not benefiting from what this organization or this government department should be doing. And so when you're part of a system, the system says to you, this is the way to do things here. If you want to be part of this, if you want to survive, this is what happens in this particular system. And it takes a lot of courage, and we'll talk about that later, but it takes a lot of courage to actually be able to stand up and say, no, I'm not going to do this, because there's always consequences when you start to stand against the mainstream.
Yeah. Sammy, I think that sets us up well for the case study that we're going to be looking at today, which takes our listeners back to, again, to the Roman Empire and to the time of the early Christians, who, listeners will remember from previous episodes, we've referred to this numbers of times, at that time, the Christian population was tiny. They assembled in tiny groups, typically based in people's homes, and they were also participants in a brutal system, the system of the Roman Empire. Now, as a system that brought peace, when you consider that they used violent and brutal force to subjugate the whole Mediterranean basin, nevertheless, once they'd subjugated it, there was peace and a degree of prosperity. But that system was not just put in place because of the brute force of the Roman legions going out and conquering regions of the Mediterranean and Europe. But then subsequently after that, the whole Roman system functioned on the basis of the slave system. To help people understand exactly how that worked, you're talking about slavery as the foundational economic building block of the Roman Empire. Slaves made up, in general, 10 to 20% of the whole population across the Roman Empire. In Italy, which of course was the seat of power, where Rome was situated, slaves made up 30 to 40% of the population. So if you lived in a place like Rome, it's probably the case that if you're out at the shops, every sixth person that you walked past was a slave. They were completely essential to life. But most slaves were in households, and the household was the basic economic unit of the Roman Empire. It was a social economic unit. It was extremely important to Roman society. It was the glue, and it was the economic engine. And within that, humans were the unit of production, human slaves specifically. And they were commodities. So Cicero, who was a very well-known aristocrat from the time of Julius Caesar, once conducted a conquest of a part of modern-day Turkey. And as a result of that, he had slaves that he obtained, captives after this military victory. And he refers to their sale, and he says, as I write, there is about 120,000 sesterces, which basically is a way of saying about $300,000 on the platform. So he refers to slaves purely according to their price tag. So they were a commodity. And people became slaves through being captured, as I just mentioned, in warfare, being captured by slave traders. But also people would sell themselves into slavery in order to take their family out of poverty. Even though you didn't earn a wage as a slave, you were fed. And it was a way of avoiding the worst aspects of poverty. What a slave did was to basically help a Roman household to run. And in fact, what's so interesting about slaves is that they could actually become quite senior. They could run a whole household. In a sense, it would be like running a small family business today. It would actually be in the hands of a slave. The slave could end up having significant responsibility. but no rights came with that responsibility. They were property to be used as the owner wished, and they could be treated harshly, even quite brutally. They could be sexually assaulted, especially for a Roman male. Any member of his household that wasn't family was fair game, sexually speaking, male or female. Some were treated well. Some ended up getting their freedom. They could, if they could earn money on the side and still do their job, they could make enough money to buy their freedom. It might be that a master takes to his slave and eventually decides to grant them freedom. That didn't happen to many. To be granted your freedom wasn't necessarily a plus, because it meant you were back out on the street and you might even be worse off than when you were a slave. And a runaway slave could be beaten or branded or even crucified. And you and I are looking now at the story of exactly one of those people, a household slave who ran away. It's a slave called Onesimus, and he ran away from a Christian owner called Philemon. And then he meets Paul, this well-known Christian leader, one of the key leaders who was, in a sense, rolling out the Christian faith by sharing it in different parts of the Roman Empire. People are becoming Christians, people like Philemon, who are household masters, who have households full of slaves, becoming Christians. It's in this context that this happens. Paul meets Onesimus, and their relationship builds, and then there's an outcome to this where Paul then engages Philemon and writes him a letter encouraging Philemon to receive Onesimus back, but in a way that is quite radical relative to how the Roman culture and system usually worked. In a sense, what is helpful about hearing this letter and knowing what was meant to happen in the Roman context helps us understand or get some insight into how we as Christians can handle a situation where we are part of an institution, like slavery in this case, and it is unthinkable to change it. Paul or Philemon, and definitely not Onesimus, that nobody had any mechanism for being able to take on the Roman Empire and this institution of slavery. And yet this letter has the effect of fundamentally undermining, in a redemptive way, this horrendous institution, and sows the seeds of change. So I'm not going to read every word of the letter because it would take too long, but I'll read aspects of it. Paul, a prisoner of Messiah Jesus and Timothy our brother, to Philemon, our dearly loved friend and our co-worker, to Apphia our sister, to Archippus, our fellow soldier, and to the church in your house. So here we have a Roman household. Philemon is the head. And then Paul moves on and he says, grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Messiah. I thank God as I remember you in my prayers, because I hear of your faith in the Lord Jesus and your love for all the saints, all the holy ones. I pray that the faith that you share with us may deepen your understanding of the blessing that is possible in the Messiah. I have had great joy and encouragement because of your love, for the hearts of the saints have been refreshed through you, my brother. So being in the Messiah, or in Christ, I have a lot of confidence to command you to do what is right, but I would rather appeal to you on the basis of love. I, Paul, an elder, and now a prisoner for the sake of Jesus Christ, I'm appealing to you concerning my child, whose spiritual father I have become during my time in prison. That is Onesimus, which is Greek for useful. He was formerly useless to you, but now he is useful to you and to me. And I have sent him, who is my very heart, back to you. I wanted to keep him so that he could serve me in your place during my imprisonment for the sake of the good news. However, I didn't want to do anything without your approval, so that your good deed would not come from a place of obligation, but from a place of willingness. So perhaps it was for this reason that he was separated from you for a little while, so that you would have him back forever, no longer a slave, but more than a slave, a dear brother. He is especially so to me, and he is more so to you now, both humanly speaking and in the Lord. Therefore, if you regard me as a partner, receive Onesimus as you would receive me. Now, if he has wronged you in any way, or he owes you anything, charge it to my account. I, Paul, have written this letter with my own hand. I will repay it. I could also mention that you owe me your very self. Yes, brother, let me benefit from you in the Lord. Refresh my heart in the Messiah. And there's more that concludes that letter. But here we have a letter in which Paul is writing to this household owner. He doesn't say to him, it's appalling that you have even a single slave in your home. And therefore, a good start would be to receive Onesimus back as a brother in Christ and let your slaves go. He doesn't do anything like that. Before we address the question of what he does say, we do need to think about the context itself. And again, we touched on this earlier, but what would it have looked like if you're going to change a system, Sammy, as entrenched as, say, the slave system that ran, that actually was the operating model of a Roman household? It has to be replaced by something. So in systems change, how would you make such a revolutionary change work? You know, like in your work in business or in the government context?
The obvious thing about how to change a system, and we often gravitate towards that, and it's an error in itself, is to think the top guy needs to change, the top guy needs to make an announcement or a pronouncement, and once they make a pronouncement, then we all fall in line. That's a kind of typical thing. So you kind of say, okay, so let's try and get to the Roman emperor. And if we get to the Roman emperor and we get him to say something and to cancel this, then we've won. But we know that in many cases that all that does is actually drive insubordination of some kind. And sometimes it also forces the issue underground. So you're thinking that we have now this pronouncement and everybody's going to fall in line because it comes from the top. And then what you end up is just driving it underground. People then submit to it, but they're not really, it's compliance driven. It's compliance. Yes, boss, I'm going to do it because you're here and you're watching me. But it doesn't really speak to the inner change. Doesn't speak to the inner change. And there's lots of those kind of things that have been forced upon organizations or society where we have missed out the actual change. On the other hand, you could go with a almost grounds-up approach and say, okay, let's start a revolution of some kind at the grounds level. Now, it's been interesting watching some of the revolutions, even in countries that have been going on. And initially, many of them start very well with very well-meaning people. We've had, for example, recently in Kenya, some young people who have risen up and said, it's unjust what is going on about taxation. It's unjust the corruption in the country. It's not right. And so some young people started to coalesce together and to build up momentum. And for some moment, we thought, oh, wow, here is an Arab Spring revolution. This is good. We will see some changes. But with time, it still builds up to somebody somewhere at the top of that revolution, then taking advantage of this groundswell movement, and before you know it, sometimes it's even worse than before. So I know I'm not addressing the question directly, but what I'm saying is that it's quite a challenging issue. And you look at Paul's situation and you think, so we sitting here and expecting Paul to say something, but actually Paul, in his circumstances, he's in prison. He's actually in prison himself. So what would Paul in prison saying do anything about this unjust system? Yeah. So it raises more questions for me than answers.
Yeah. And any revolution that we can look at in history, and bless my American friends, but they have a revolution too that started off their nation. And yet I can't think of a revolution that was, in some way, the use of force to bring about the overcoming of what was perceived or believed to be an unjust situation that doesn't then lead to more harm in some way, more destruction. The French Revolution was built on liberty, equality, and fraternity, but it was a time of massive bloodletting, and it was justified. In a sense, the genocide in Rwanda was justified. It was the overcoming of injustice. That was how it was rationalized. These are how revolutions really show up. So it seems that, you know, what you're describing, Sammy, is that typically there are these two choices. There's fiat decree. There's somebody who changes a law, imposes a new system, and people are forced to respond to that. Or there's a revolution, and in fact, it doesn't actually solve anything. It just creates more destruction, more alienation.
been enjoying the conversation so far, please share with your friends so that more people can discover how their faith can shape a better world.
I think it will help listeners to understand a little bit more of the complexity of what Paul is dealing with here. Now, in Roman society, we've talked about the household, and this is the basic building block of the entire, especially in the Roman culture in Italy, but across the Roman Empire, was the building block. Then socially, the way affairs were conducted was very much on a client-patron system, where you were always in a position of hierarchy relative to other people. And the role of somebody who's superior to you is to do favors for you. And the more favors they do, the more honor they gain. And you want to be in relationship with somebody of that kind of status or stature, because then you get favors and you get to move ahead in life. But this is how this system works. And it's interesting because within this system, there is actually a place for not doing things by simply harsh measures. You could actually show mercy, for example. You could forgive someone something, but you would always do so as a superior. It's actually, if you were to show mercy to someone, it means you are in the superior position. To illustrate that a bit further, there's actually a letter from a Romanist aristocrat called Pliny the Younger, who writes in a very, very similar situation to a friend of his called Sabinianus. And I'm not going to read the whole letter, but to illustrate the points that I'm making, there's some points of comparison, because he is writing to a situation where Sabinianus is angry, not with a slave, but a slave who's been freed. And there's something wrong in their relationship, and that former slave has come to Pliny and asked Pliny to intervene as a kind of mediator. So in this situation, you have Sabinius as a homeowner, a bit like Philemon, and he's appealing to Pliny to kind of intervene because Pliny has a superior status. And basically, Pliny is agreeing with him, yes, you have every right to be angry. And he says at one point, I encourage you to be merciful, but if at some point in the future you want to get angry because you feel like your mercy hasn't received the response it should, you're entirely justified. You have a position of authority over this man. He's actually saying, don't torture him. And that's a real thing he could have done. He then says, but instead show mercy. At the end of his letter to Sabinianus, he says, it's possible I shall make another request to you and I will receive it from you, always supposing that it's an appropriate thing for me to ask and for you to grant. Yours sincerely, Pliny. What he's doing there is he's saying, I'm coming to you with the expectation you'll do this. Now, I'm using my rank as a patron in a patron-client society. And so he's doing what you talked about earlier. He's using compliance to implement mercy so that this freedman gets some relief. But he's using his authority over Sabinianus to make this happen. And then he's also utilizing mercy in the way that it can be used in the Roman context. It keeps Sabinianus in the superior position, because Sabinianus will grant mercy to this man if he follows what Pliny is saying, and then this man, the relationship in a sense is addressed. But everybody's been kept in their place in this letter. Pliny is the highest of status, then there's Sabinianus, who's a Roman household owner, and he has rank over the freedman. And that is how Roman culture worked. That's the best it could offer. Nothing actually changes in Pliny's letter. And yet we have something radically different happening with Paul's letter to Onesimus.
Yeah, I think, Jonathan, one of the things that even just from what you've been talking about comes to mind is, so if we go with a top down and there's a rule or an edict that has been proclaimed, or somebody has said something about it, somebody says superior, what is the end result of that, especially to the other party? At the end of it, you are more obliged to me you're more subordinated to me. So I have more power than at the beginning. And that seems to be even, you know, I look at our justice system. So you've done something wrong. We take you to prison and you come out. But when you come out, you're actually labeled as an ex-convict. So you're actually, in many cases, in a worse-off situation. When you walk in the society, people point out to you and they will say, that's an ex-convict. And so at the end result of that is that you're actually in a worse, you're much more subordinated to the society that sent you to prison than before. And I think what I'm hearing from the conversation around Philemon is us getting into an imagination of an alternative way that leaves that particular individual not in a worse off state than before, not in a place where the relationship is more, I have more power than you just because of my act of forgiveness on you.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting, if we start with Pliny's letter to his friend Sabinianus as our point of comparison, then we go back to Paul's letter to Philemon. It's really interesting to see the points of contrast and comparison, because one of the points, in a sense, of comparison is Onesimus, who clearly in some way was a runaway slave, we mentioned that earlier, he is being sent back to Philemon. And there's actually a comment in Paul's letter that implies that he owes something, that Onesimus owes Philemon something material that Paul is offering to compensate Philemon for. So to summarize, what we have is a situation where in terms of the Roman order, the person who's in most trouble is Onesimus, because he ran away, and that's actually an offense for which he could have been crucified, at the very least beaten. So he's run away, and he appears to have stolen. And so if they were following the Roman, what's possible, the worst outcome would have been branding or beating or even executing Onesimus. The best possible outcome would have been forgiving him, and he is restored to his slave, or not restored, but he returns to his slave work, and Philemon has granted him mercy, and everything carries on. And instead, something very, very different happens, because Paul sends him back. And by the way, that language of being sent back is the language, we don't pick this up in the English, but in the Greek, is the language of being sent back for a legal review. So he's actually saying implicitly to Philemon, within the Roman system, you can exercise your rights as a homeowner and conduct a legal review of Onesimus. And then he tells him what to do with that. He says to Philemon, welcome him as you would welcome me. And here's where I want to pull in the patron-client thing. The way this letter's working, it's clear that in Philemon's mind, or in Philemon and Paul's relationship, Paul has the patron role. And so he is acting within that function, but he's handling it very differently. And so he says to him, receive him as you would receive me. In other words, receive your former slave or your runaway slave as you would receive me, who is actually your superior, your social superior. Receive him as you would receive me. Welcome him as you would welcome me. And he says, no longer a slave, but more than a slave, a dear brother. So there, in just a few words, he reconstitutes their relationship. And so instead of the question being, how can you own a slave? I think the implicit question from this letter is, how can you enslave a brother?
Yeah. I actually think, you know, as you're talking about it, I'm thinking, who's on trial here?
Mm.
And it's Philemon. It's Philemon who's on trial. It's a guy in power, in a sense, is the one who is on trial, if I may use that.
Yeah, he's being tested.
He's being tested. So it's the person in power, and how are you going to use the power that you have in this? So it's like Paul is using the patron-client relationship to actually put Philemon that the issue, yes, there is an issue with Onesimus, but it's really you who is on the dock here around how you're going to use your power.
So I keep circling back, Sammy, to the reality. Like it's easy for us to read in hindsight and think of what could have been said or should have been said or what was said and how powerful it is or isn't and evaluate it, you know, in that way. But to look at it from the reality on the ground, I mentioned this earlier, Paul's in prison as he's writing. Philemon is a homeowner, but within the larger scheme of things, he's not a man of power. I mean, if Paul is his patron and Paul's in prison, you know, he's not exactly a man of weight here. And then, of course, as we said, Onesimus has nothing to bring to the table, socially speaking. So for us listening to this, I think it's really helpful for us to say, to self-reflect and go, what limits on agency do I perceive myself to have? And then hear the dynamics that are going on in this story with that in mind, because Paul's in prison. And at the beginning, he says to Philemon in this letter, I thank God as I remember you in my prayers because I hear of your faith in the Lord Jesus and your love for all the saints. And I pray that the faith that you share with us may deepen your understanding of the blessing that is possible in the Messiah. He's in prison and he's saying there is massive possibility for good, for redemption, for blessing in Christ. And then I think the letter is him saying what that possibility is. Yeah, so I do believe that when Paul is talking about all this potential that we have in Christ, the potential for blessing or for good, that he's basically prefacing what he wants to say in the letter. This letter is an explanation of what those possibilities are. So if we think about our own lives and we think about what we think needs to be addressed and we look and say, it's just too big. The forces arrayed against us are too massive and they're dark, as well as the forces within ourselves. And yet he's saying there's potential here. And it fleshes out in two key ways, the one we mentioned, which is that, in a sense, he never explicitly says, release Onesimus, give him freedom. He implies it. It is there. But he's saying, receive him as a brother. And one of the things in the Roman household system is a homeowner could grant freedom to a slave. We've talked about that. He could also adopt a slave as a son. So you could have freedom, and then you could be adopted as a son, and then you actually have household status, you have family status. He's not even offering that. There was no mechanism to become a brother. You could become a son, you're still the junior. You know, you could receive the inheritance even, but you're still the son of the homeowner. This is different. He's made him a brother. And how do you enslave a brother, as we said earlier? But secondly, on top of that, and I find this fascinating because you and I have talked a lot about restitution, like in the South African context, and it comes up in episode 2 as well, in my conversation with Simon Lerapolo. But here we have a situation where in the Roman context, now we would say, well, the one who really received an injustice was Onesimus, but in the Roman context, Onesimus A, ran away, and B, appears to have stolen, and Paul offers to pay that outstanding debt. Paul offers. He doesn't say to Philemon, forgive it. He acknowledges that it's real. I mean, there's clearly some genuine material loss that has taken place here. And Paul is saying he will account for it. There's three things going on here. There's the fact that the one making these recommendations is in prison. There's the fact that he is completely subverting the Roman hierarchy and making the slave a brother, but a brother in love, not a brother by fiat, you know, by force. But then on top of that, he's acknowledging that there's been material harm and he's offering to take care of it. He's the third party. He's actually the patron in the Roman hierarchy. And I just think, how could this dynamic show up today? Where the one who didn't get harmed offers to pay the debt for the one who got harmed and on behalf of the one who did the harm. There's so many dynamics going on here. It's an incredible letter.
And I think for me, you know, as just listening to you as facilitators of, you know, as Christians with our obligation and calling to be agents of reconciliation, it comes at a cost and should come at a cost to us. I know the many times when I have wrestled in pain looking at particular parties where reconciliation is not happening. And I think what Paul is acknowledging here is that it's not just a neutral catalyst and I remain unchanged in it. The moment you enter into a system, you're part of that system. And so the pain of that system, I know many times when I've watched, I've worked with people where there's conflict. And just by entering into that, you find yourself also now having sleepless nights or troubled as well. You're not, you're anxious as well. And so there's a cost to it. And I think Paul is himself acknowledging that just by engaging in this relationship, he also now becomes party to what is going on.
In one sense, it's easy to read a letter like this. Maybe not easy, but one of the easier things for us to do in reading a letter like this is to distill some of the principles. I think the harder thing is to then connect those principles back into our lived experience. How do we take that from, oh, those are very nice principles, to living those out in the complicated, complex systems that we're in now? Like, I think it'd be good here to try and get specific or try and illustrate or to make tangible these things. And to your point earlier, Sammy, not necessarily by saying this is how we should do it, but wrestling with where might this show up.
Yeah. I remember working in a particular government department. I was working in 3-4 government departments as a consultant. And this particular government department, the leader of that government department, we were doing one-on-one coaching sessions, and she got to see it. She got to, I don't know how else I could describe it, but it's almost like there was meaningful personal transformation in herself, where she admitted her own weaknesses, her own insecurities, and was able to now say, okay, this is what I've been trying to hide from the others, that I'm actually incredibly insecure. I am not an expert in what I'm supposed to be leading in the field. And so through that process, got her to see that she could actually harness the creative wisdom and expertise that was in that room that she was missing. And when that personal transformation changed, she was now able to actually use, could I say, her power, her positional power, but this time not in saying, this must stop or this must end. It was in a relationship, building relationships with her subordinates, inviting them to come alongside her. She still was the leader, and she exercised that leadership in a very relational way. She was able to open up to them and say, I'm not an expert in this particular area. I've been appointed your head, but I'm not necessarily a technical expert, so I need you to come alongside me. And within 6 months, we saw a government department that changed. I mean, you could walk into any of the corridors of that government department and you would hear people, even the language in the department changed. They started cleaning the walls. They started cleaning the reception area that was extremely filthy. And just recently, I was in a town somewhere and somebody walked up to me in a wedding and said, I remember you from that particular time. You guys changed the department. And I thought, wow, it was actually not me. There was nothing much I was doing. But so I think it's this idea of this subtle but very revolutionary change that Paul is inviting Philemon to, of a personal inner transformative journey, that when you go through that, then you exercise the power that you have in a different way, which is much more relational, which is much more sustainable in the long run.
I've said this before in this series, but in my view, a just society, firstly, a just society won't be achieved this side of eternity. There will always be messes that we get ourselves into. But a just society is, in essence, a society in which people love each other, not a society that has the best laws. It is a society in which people naturally serve each other, naturally look out for each other's interests. And what reconciliation is, and what we're seeing here in this letter, is it's a mechanism, or it's a dynamic, better, that pulls people back into a relationship that can work well because offense has been covered, and relationship has been restored, but there's an expectation that the restored relationship then functions by a certain dynamic, a certain power, and that is the power of love. I wrestle with this all the time. How is that meant to show up in my life?
And I think, Jonathan, whether we are wrestling with large system issues, or we're wrestling with personal family dynamics or workplace dynamics that are not working well, I think what Paul invites us in this book is to, number one, as you've mentioned, intention, to see ourselves as driven by kingdom values, that there's an intentionality about it to restore this relationship, to seek the restoration of these relationships. Now, seeking and achieving them may be two different things, but to seek. I think the second one for me is imagination. And that calls for creativity. It calls for us to think, to imagine what a better state. This may be the current state of this relationship, but what could be a better state? We were talking on the way here about how many times we think about what is a minimum basic wage. And so if I'm paying my house help or I'm paying a gardener the minimum wage, then I've done fine. But by whose standard? Can you imagine a better life for that particular individual, a better relationship? What would that look like, even from their own eyes for themselves? What would that look like? So I think I hear Paul inviting Philemon to that imagination of what could this relationship look like if you treated Onesimus as your brother? And then the third one, I think, for me is initiative. You got to do something. You got to do something. It's to look at what is our area of influence. How do I use my areas of influence? And, when I think about a situation like Ukraine and I'm here in South Africa, it may feel like I don't have any influence, but it may be just a small bit of saying, is there someone that I can link with who does something that, that small bit. The world has become a global village. So I find that next door to me are people who come from Israel, who come from Palestine, who come from Ukraine. Is there a way who come from Somali, who come from the Democratic Republic of Congo? It's almost like God has brought the world to me.
So, Sammy, I'm thinking of covering two things now as a way of kind of wrapping up our overall conversation. The one is how long change takes. And then secondly, returning to this idea of complicity that we're actually a part of when we contribute to brokenness in the systems that we live in and work in. But when it comes to the time it takes for change to happen, so, we're reading a letter that was written in the first century AD, encouraging basically a dynamic that fundamentally undermines and subverts the Roman order, but doesn't implement that in any structural sense. It's purely at a relational level. But the first time in history that slavery is formally addressed at a legislative level, that it is in Britain in the 1700s, when firstly the trade of slaves was abolished. And that was something that Paul actually explicitly condemned, was the trade of slaves. So the 1700s is when the trade of slaves is abolished. And then 10 years or so after the trade was abolished, the institution of slavery itself was abolished in the British Empire. And then the British used their military might to police that and to enforce it. So we're in South Africa, and because of British political involvement in South Africa, it was actually the British abolition of the slave trade and slavery that then led to slavery being shut down in South Africa. But we're talking about 1700, 1800 years after Paul wrote this letter. And I think it's very important for us to consider how long it can take. I mean, I don't think we need to think necessarily in terms of thousands of years, but truly revolutionary change that then permeates a society and a system and a structure can take a very, very long time. And we need to be prepared for that. So I think to come back to this question about what do we do, the question is, what do I do now? What do I do with what's in front of me, like you said, in my sphere of influence?
And I think the first one is to journey with the question. Allow the question to be your guide. We've kind of painted faith and Christianity as come to Christ, you'll have the answers. But it's actually more important to journey with a question. I think of, you know, of other examples where people come to Christ and they're asking particular question and they're looking for an answer. And Jesus gives them a parable and then he says to them, who's your neighbor? And leaves it there. When I look at what situations of injustice, whether at the workplace or wherever, it should pose in us a question that leaves us uncomfortable. If it doesn't pose that question, then there's a problem with our faith. Faith cannot be an answer. Faith is about a quest. And I think the second one is to see ourselves as pieces of a bigger puzzle. We are part of a bigger puzzle, God's tapestry. John Newton would not have known what influence he'd have on Wilberforce and vice versa. And Wilberforce, trying to write those letters, doesn't know what impact he's going to have around the world. So it's much more a question about how do I become faithful to what God has called me in my space, in my time, in my influence. And I think the third one that you mentioned is to see the bigger value chain than just the bottle of water that I'm taking. To remember that that bottle of water, by the time it gets to me, it came from somewhere, and that empty container is going somewhere. So let me also be curious about where did it come from? Where is it going to after it leaves me? Because we tend to just see the light switch, which I switch on. But the power that I'm using right now came from somewhere, and it's going, whatever I do with it is going somewhere. And if I can just ask that question, it will help me to see that I am part of a bigger problem chain, but I can also be part of a bigger solution chain.
Yeah, that's great.
As I listen to you, I come back as well to this fact that, speaking of that value chain and the problem chain, that I think this is really important. Especially as Christians, but for anybody who's pursuing, you know, and cares about large scale change, is that while I'm in the journey, my own hands are dirty. Not because I consciously or willfully participate in some aspect of sin or wrong, but because of the system that I'm a part of. And so I think this entire conversation that we're in, to me is about inspiring us to be ambitious, to be curious, like you were saying, about the larger picture that I'm a part of, but at the same time, compelling us or constraining us to be humble, to know that we'll play a part, and it's very important that we're intentional, that we're seeking out what that part is, but also knowing that while I do that, my hands are dirty, I'm complicit in some way, and I can only be carried forward in doing God's work by being carried in grace. I have to allow for the fact that I need the grace and the forgiveness of God in ways that I don't even know about, even as I seek to be part of some grand social change project. What I think is so powerful about this letter is that it shows us how powerful grace is. Like we live in a world of activism. Like we want to do stuff that makes stuff happen. And instead, there's dynamics of love, service, sacrifice that yield healthy relationships that have a completely new dynamic to them, this dynamic of grace that we're talking about. And this alone subverts how the Roman household system typically worked and the system of Roman hierarchy. It completely turns it on its head. And I guess I come to the end of our conversation thinking, what does it mean to subvert the order that I'm in through grace, as opposed to tackling it because I'm angry about this injustice or that problem? What does it mean to subvert the order I'm in through grace? Where does that show up?
There may be times, Jonathan, for much more stronger, much more overt. So we're not saying that there's no place for that. But there are many times when what we do may actually appear in the short term like we are actually supportive of being complicit of an unjust system. But then if we have our eye on the bigger picture, then we know that it's a subversive appearance of compliance, because there's something much more deeper going on. Think about the mustard seed. It's that idea that I think that's what I'm taking from this conversation with us, that in whatever situations we find ourselves in, we have this long-term view of something about God's kingdom. But even if in the meanwhile, it may appear like we are complicit within that, but we keep the view on the long term.
And to your point, I think it's really important. If we have opportunity to participate in structural change, we should chase it. So, you know, the abolition of the slave trade began with William Wilberforce and others taking initiative in their time. He was a member of parliament in the UK, and he had the agency, like in the cultural, social context that he was in, to actually start to do something to address things at the legislative level. However, I think what remains important is to say, if you are in a position where you have, in terms of your social context, power, cultural power, social power, how do you use that power? Is it going to have at its heart this grace, which rebuilds and restores relationships? Or is it going to just be a new form of force to bring about what you believe to be good? And what we're talking about is something that brings about, ultimately, relationships that are truly just. Well, Sammy, that has been a fantastic conversation. And I'm so grateful for, well, I'm always grateful for you as a friend. And I'm grateful for you being with me today, because you have so much wisdom that you've acquired through your years. And thank you for bringing that to us.
Yeah, thank you for having me here. It's been a joy.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. As always, we encourage you, if you've been enjoying this podcast, to go online and review it on your favorite podcast platform. And then please be sure to come back in 2 weeks for the final episode, The Ordinary Pursuit of Big Change. We will be joined by Justina Ojom, who lives in pursuit of big change in very contrasting worlds. She is, on the one hand, an actress and a dancer, and she is a design thinking consultant who for some years now has participated in initiatives to address gender-based violence. So come back for what is sure to be, knowing Justina, a deeply thoughtful and compelling episode. Until then, this is goodbye from me, Jonathan Wilson.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partnered together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. Ziwani is a Mergon initiative. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.